Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest the next hour has written an absolutely fascinating book. Marcus Redeker is the author's name. The book is The Amistad Rebellion, An Atlantic Odyssey of Slavery and Freedom. I think most of us know this story because of Steven Spielberg's film in 1997, and that even was a while ago. But for those who don't know the story, there was a slave ship, Amistad, that set sail from Havana on June 28th of 1839 on a delivery of human cargo. The 53 Africans being held captive below deck took control of the ship, setting themselves on a new course of freedom. It was not a nonviolent episode. When they attempted to sail to a safe port, they were captured by the U.S. Navy. They were put in jail in Connecticut. And then the legal battle for their freedom went all the way to the Supreme Court. The story is just so interesting. One of the people arguing on behalf of their freedom was John Quincy Adams. And they won, and they were eventually returned to Africa. It was a huge story in this country. Thousands of people visited the jail where these slaves were. It was written about. It was widely debated in this country. And then people didn't hear about it for a long period of time. And it's become something that we're talking about again. But our guest this hour believes that we can learn a lot about the story by looking at the backgrounds of the African slaves, and that indeed is what he has done. Amistad Africans came from a region, he writes, about which the people of European descent in 1839 knew almost nothing. So he concentrates on their societies and who they were in Sierra Leone many, many years ago. So that's what we're talking about this hour. It should be really interesting. And our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And join us, please. We'd love to hear from you. Marcus, thank you. Oh, I should tell you about Marcus. Marcus is a distinguished professor of Atlantic history at the University of Pittsburgh. He's also author of The Slave Ship, A Human History, and we're welcoming him now to our show. Hello, Marcus. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, it's a fascinating, fascinating story. For those who are not familiar, and there are a lot of people who are not familiar with this story, please, before we talk about the African background of many of these people on the Amistad, please talk about how this story was so huge in the United States. I was amazed how big it was.
It was really quite a spectacular story, Kathleen. It captured the imagination of the entire nation, and in fact, it was much discussed all around the Atlantic world. Some of the best signs of how popular the Amistad Rebellion actually was included a play performed in New York. Now, they came ashore in Connecticut. So in New York, literally 6 days after they came ashore, there was a play being performed about their uprising aboard the ship. And this was actually a hit of the season. Thousands of people saw it.
Nice.
So that the play itself not only depicted the rebellion, it actually helped to spread the news of it. Some other examples of its popularity, there were a number of artists who went into New Haven Jail, where the Amistad Africans were kept. They sketched their portraits, some in pencil. One man painted a 165-foot panorama of the rebellion, which he took around to different places and set it up and charged admission so people could see this dramatic event. And one of my favorites is this. Another artist went into the jail and some way or other secured the cooperation of the Amistad Africans and made 29 life-size figures.
Goodness.
which he then arranged again in the moment of the rebellion, and this was shown in various art galleries. Again, admission would be charged, and thousands of people flocked to see this too, just because they were so interested in this extraordinary case.
We just did a show, and I read this book. I've neglected him all my life, and at the interview I said, where have you been, John Quincy Adams, all my life? Because he's such a fascinating president. But he was front and center in arguing for their freedom, wasn't he?
Yes, John Quincy Adams played a very important role. He really doesn't enter the story until fairly late. This is, as you've said, an Atlantic drama of slavery and freedom. But when the case finally made its way through the American legal system and got up to the Supreme Court levels, John Quincy Adams joined the legal team and gave an impassioned speech, actually two speeches of about 6 hours each.
Whew.
In which, by all accounts, he dazzled everyone. He didn't always talk about the law, and one of the few comments that we have from the Supreme Court judges was from Chief Justice Story, who said, Mr. Adams gave a remarkable oration, but it really had very little to do with the law. What it had to do with was the morality, mm-hmm. or the immorality of slavery, and the way in which these people who had fought for their freedom had essentially done what Americans had done under George Washington when they fought against tyranny of Great Britain. So Adams played a remarkable role. He was called Old Man Eloquent for a very good reason.
Mm-hmm. The fascination, you write, with this story would not last. It disappeared from the histories of the U.S. within the late 19th and early 20th century. No major revival until new social movements exploded in this country in the 60s and the 70s. Why did we bury the story for so long?
Well, I think two groups of people tried very hard to keep it alive, and that they would be abolitionists. People who wanted to glory in the successful struggle against slavery, and also African-American artists and writers, and of course they were abolitionists too. They wanted to remember this victory because that's what's really important about it. It was a successful slave revolt, and it thereby occupied an especially important place in the imagination of those who wanted a different kind of world. In the later 19th century, we often forget the rise of ideas like social Darwinism meant that racism was really institutionalized in a lot of different ways in the United States, and I would say most especially in universities. So at that time, memory of things like the Amistad Rebellion tended to recede from view, and it really took the civil rights movement in the 1960s to bring it back to public consciousness. And that's because in that period, we began to think that we really needed a different and more complex history as we thought about trying to change the world. And in that context, Cinque, the leader of the rebellion, and the rebellion itself reemerged in our public consciousness.
Mm. And it was fortunate, and it was unfortunate that the whole experience happened for those who were slaves, but it was fortunate for us and for the whole discussion that these people could speak, the slaves that is, many languages. They spoke many languages when they lived in Africa. They were voracious students. They spoke about issues. They learned English. They were able to, some of them did, communicate about what happened. They gave us a wealth of information about who they were and what their cause was and what happened, right?
Well, this is really one of the most important points and had never really been talked about, in my view, in the previous histories. When the Amistad Africans were put in New Haven jail, they stayed there for over a year as their court case made its way through the American legal system. The moment they were in the jail, American abolitionists, black and white, but mostly white, came into the jail in order to work with them. One, to organize a campaign, but also to try to publicize the issue of slavery and to use this event to turn people against that institution. So what happened in the jail between the Amistad Africans, who had made this successful insurrection, and these mostly middle-class white abolitionists, was a fascinating thing to observe and to see how they mutually educated each other. because the Amistad Africans had a lot to learn about the United States, but on the other hand, the abolitionists had a lot to learn about Africa and about slavery.
Mm-hmm. When they arrived here in the United States, did they have any knowledge of whether this was a slave country or a not slave country?
Well, in the voyage, after they captured the vessel, in their uprising, they kept two Cuban slave owners alive with the hope that they would navigate them back across the Atlantic to their homeland in Sierra Leone. They were at sea for several weeks. It was very hard going. And finally, one of the Cubans said, "We will take you to a free country. We can't make it to Africa. We'll take you to a free country." And, of course, they wanted to know, what free country is that? And the Cuban said, "Well, it's the United States." Now, the United States was not a free country in 1839. It was, in fact, the world's preeminent slave society. And I'm sure that this Cuban slave owner really wanted to take the Amistad Africans to Charleston, South Carolina, which was the heart of the South and the slave economy. But they managed actually to get to the northern end of Long Island. And when the Amistad Africans first went ashore, they saw some men there who were hunting. After this long voyage, in which they were very hungry and very thirsty and quite sick, when they came ashore, they didn't ask for food. They didn't ask for water. They asked, "Is this slavery country?"
Yes.
And when the men said, "No, it's a free country," they rejoiced and they celebrated, and they had actually managed to get to a part of the United States where slavery had been abolished. It had been abolished in New York in 1827. So that's what gave them the chance to win their freedom in court.
Interesting. Let's talk, because so little has been written, and so now you've done this book and more has been written about their lives in Africa, which made them who they were and made all of this possible. You talk about this society, the Poro Society, I think that's how you pronounce it, that many of them would have been members of. It is a secret society. What did you learn about this society and how it may have influenced the actions that they took and the people they were?
Yes, so let me begin by saying that on board the Amistad, there were 53 enslaved Africans, and 49 of them were men. This was for a regional shipment of slaves to a new booming sugar region. 49 men and 4 children. Of the 4 children, 3 little girls, 1 little boy. All of the men, regardless of their ethnicity, and they were probably around 10 or 12 different ethnicities, meaning different West African nations, so to speak. All of them came from societies where they had this institution called the Poro Society. All adult men were initiated into it. And it turns out this is really central to the social life of all of those societies in southern Sierra Leone from which the Amistad Africans came. The Poro Society basically provided the social discipline of daily life. It adjudicated disputes. It trained boys to become warriors and to become men. It dealt with issues like witchcraft, and crucially, it declared war. The Poro Society would declare war. So what I was very curious to find out was, how did the Amistad Africans organize themselves as they were trying to rise up and seize the ship? And the more I read about southern Sierra Leone, the more I thought, well, down in the hold of that vessel, they were holding a Poro meeting. So how to prove that became the question. And I did finally find evidence, and compelling evidence. So what was happening really was a fundamental institution of West Africa was being used in the hold of a vessel in the northern Caribbean, and this is what allowed the Africans to essentially organize and wage a successful uprising.
You also write a great deal about the communities from which these people came, the collaborative communal nature of many of these societies.
That's right. This is very important. These were West Africans, and we have to understand who they were, how they thought about themselves, how they thought about others, and this meant going back and trying to recapture some of the texture of their own native societies. Many of the Amistad men were rice farmers. Some of them were weavers. All of them, crucially, had been trained as warriors. And this is partly because the slave trade was extending into the interior of Sierra Leone, and there were a whole series of wars surrounding it. That meant that probably all of the Amistad men had experienced war and had actually fought in wars, trained in the use of weapons. And, of course, this, too, becomes absolutely crucial to their ability to organize a successful uprising.
Mm. You would think that those slave masters would have shied away from those people who had skills like that.
Well, you would think so, and it's kind of fascinating to know what they, to try to figure out what they knew about the people that they had bought and wanted to take to these slave plantations. And I did find a very interesting piece of evidence which sheds some light on this, but also expresses the confidence of those slaveholders. It came out later that when those two slave owners were buying the Amistad men, the captain of the ship that they had come from Sierra Leone to Havana in had warned him that they had already tried to organize rebellion aboard his ship and that he should be very careful with them. Well, as one of these slave owners later said, he said, "We didn't care who they were. All we wanted was their slave labor, and that's why we bought them." But it turns out that the fact that they had had these sorts of skills and these sorts of experiences in West Africa complicated that story considerably.
Instead, you write this very vivid and so disturbing account of checking people's fingers and joints and hurting people in the process of seeing if they were physically able to do slave labor.
Well, this is a very important part of the slave trade because in West Africa, slave traders wanted to buy those people who they felt were fit enough and strong enough to survive the Middle Passage, who would then be put to work, and some of them literally worked to death. So these people were actually sold in what would have resembled at the time cattle markets, in which you basically inspect the property that you're about to buy. This was part of the humiliation and degradation of slavery. But as you can see, given the way this story turned out, they were not defeated by it.
No, they sure weren't. Give us an idea of what had happened now in other societies in terms of abolishing slavery and in terms of particularly the British, I believe, who had anti-slavery patrols going on. I'm not sure where they were. Where were they? How extensive were they?
This is a really crucial part of the story, Kathleen, because the Amistad Africans sailed into a very important historical context. It had two parts. On the one hand, the 1830s had been a period of really quite intense slave revolt in the Caribbean, even in North America. There was a very famous uprising led by a man named Nat Turner in Southampton, Virginia, Southampton County, Virginia, in 1831. So there was a restiveness. There was a conflict. There was a strife over slavery. Part of that was that the anti-slavery movement in Great Britain had had two major successes. In 1807, that movement had abolished the slave trade on British vessels, and by 1834, they had passed a bill that would first gradually, and then in 1838, definitively, end slavery as an institution in British colonies, such as Jamaica, Barbados, and the like. So that when the Amistad arrived in this context, it was really supercharged in a lot of ways with struggles around slavery. Now, another aspect of this is that the British, because they had abolished their own slave trade, didn't want other countries to have an advantage that they didn't have. So they're making treaties with Spain and Portugal and other countries, essentially bribing them to stop the slave trade. But because Cuba and Brazil in particular were these really flourishing slave labor economies, the slave trade continued to go on, but illegally. So the British dispatched a really important fleet of warships to intercept the illegal slave traders on the coast of Africa. And that, too, is a very important part of the story.
We're going to welcome phone calls. If you'd like to join the conversation, I don't know how many of you have had a chance to read his really absorbing book, and so informative, and covers new territory as well. But many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the Amistad Rebellion. He is the author, Marcus Redeker, our guest, of The Amistad Rebellion, An Atlantic Odyssey of Slavery and Freedom. And for the first time, he carefully examines and writes about the lives of those who were a part of the Amistad Rebellion. The story has been told, and it's just a fascinating story as well of how people debated these issues in this country, that it became a huge celebrated case. The abolitionists and those who were in favor of slavery were debating this. People came to visit the members of the Amistad Rebellion in jail. There were wax figures made of them, and admission was charged for people to be able to come and see these wax figures. It was just a huge story in the United States in 1840, 1839, when all of this happened. But our guest looked at the lives of the people who were part of this and traced what was going on in their lives in Africa as well, and also takes into account all of the slave trade and how it was such a big part of capitalism, what was happening in Cuba and England and everywhere, and how so many people were keeping, enslaved people were keeping other people wealthy, like sugar people. So it's a fascinating story. Did I give you the number? 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And that's about it. So we'll be with you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour, Marcus Redeker, Distinguished Professor of Atlantic History at the University of Pittsburgh. His book is The Amistad Rebellion, An Atlantic Odyssey of Slavery and Freedom. And our first caller, I love this story. It shows you how the world has changed since not that long ago. Muhammad is joining us by phone from Pakistan, where he is listening to this show online. Ain't the world something? Let's go to Muhammad. Hi, Muhammad. Hello. Good morning, Muhammad.
Thank you, Kathleen, and thank you, Professor. I've been waiting for you to come online, for the last 3 or 4 days. I have a question which you did not touch on yet. It's a very interesting subject, and I'm very much interested in this. I wanted to ask you a question about the role of President Van Buren. He rather would have not touched the issue for the sake of expediency, because the slave trade had been illegal, and he did not want to annoy Spain. And if it wasn't for John Quincy Adams, who really was extremely passionate, as you said, in front of the Supreme Court, and Connecticut being still a slave state while New York was not, how would you compare the kind of, you know, expedient behavior of Van Buren in the context of the fact that we sort of forget about the limitations of decisions of previous presidents? Had it not been John Quincy Adams, these people, and has it not been a cause celebre for the abolitionists in New England, these people would not have gone back to Africa. And I will hang up and listen.
Thank you, Muhammad.
Yes, Muhammad, thank you very much for that question. I can see that you know quite a bit about the Amistad case, and it's a pleasure to hear from you. It is absolutely true that Martin Van Buren, who was president when the case first arose in 1839, late August 1839, was really vexed by the entire thing. He was someone who depended to some extent on the support of slave owners, and he did not want to antagonize them. On the other hand, he really probably did wish most of all that the case would just go away. But he was required to take a position, and the position of the United States government, the official position, was that the Amistad Africans were in fact slaves, not free people, not self-liberated people, not even illegally enslaved people, and that they should be returned to their so-called lawful owners in Cuba. This was the demand of the Spanish government, acting on behalf of its Cuban interests, and this was the position of the American government. So one of the most important things to understand about the Amistad case is that here you have a motley crew of 50-odd Africans and another motley crew of abolitionists who, by the way, are not popular at this moment in time. They're quite small in number. Many people think they're dangerous fanatics. So you've got these two fairly small groups arrayed against two of the most powerful governments on earth, the government of Spain and the government of the United States. So the fact that they were able to win is all the more astonishing, because the United States was basically the power that appealed this case all the way to the Supreme Court. Now, the other thing that you mentioned, which I think is very important, Muhammad, is that the popularity of the cause really made a difference, because if you look at the legal rulings that are made at every step of the process, they're surprising. They're all surprising. No one, including the abolitionists, expected any of these judges to rule in their favor. The very first judge who issued a crucial ruling, Andrew Judson, was primarily known in his day for his efforts to close down a school opened by a white woman in Connecticut to teach African-American children. He wanted to close it down. So when he was the presiding judge, all of the abolitionists assumed that they had no chance at all. And yet he ruled in their favor. Why he did so is a very interesting question. I think one reason why he did was that he saw the tremendous outpouring of support. And he himself was actually moved to visit the Amistad Africans in jail on two different occasions. And I think seeing them and having them talk to him, and what they told him was, we really want to go home, I think this humanized the situation and caused him eventually to rule in their favor. So I think the popularity of the case is really the key to the legal rulings. We have this idea that the legal realm is completely autonomous. I assure you, judges read the newspapers. And every single judge who ruled on the case noted the extraordinary degree of popular interest in it. So I think in a very real way, the Amistad Africans themselves, along with their abolitionist allies, generated such tremendous public interest and support that was crucial to the legal system. Of course, along with John Quincy Adams' work and that of the other attorney, Roger S. Baldwin, a very skilled, very high-powered attorney, these were the things that tipped the balance and made it possible for them to go home. But the fact that they did go home, we must remember, was just wildly improbable.
Right. That's what you think about. Isn't this something? They went home. I'm wondering if there was a great disparity in the coverage of this case in southern states versus northern states, or if the South even covered this.
They did cover it, and believe me, they were most unhappy by this. The really fascinating thing about this is that in the South, the papers like the Charleston Courier and the New Orleans Bee did have coverage, but they were just infuriated by the whole thing. I mean, these Africans had risen up and killed the master of their vessel.
Mm-hmm.
This was a white Cuban shipmaster by the name of Ramon Ferrer. The fact that they might get off of these charges, the fact that they might be freed, the fact that you could conceive of killing a white figure of authority, drove the southern newspapers and, in fact, the whole southern master class a little crazy. So they were quite furious about it. But and it's also true that there was a lot of pro-slavery coverage of the case in the North. We forget this, but probably the single most important newspaper arguing the slaveholder's case against the Amistad Africans was the New York Morning Herald, which was pro-slavery. The New York Sun, on the other hand, another penny press paper, was very much on the side of the Amistad Africans. So this whole thing was battled out in the press between North and South, but also within the North.
Thank you, Muhammad, so much for your call. Let's go next to Brian, and Brian is calling in Lake Villa. Hi, Brian.
Hi.
Hi.
I just had a comment earlier. Your guest mentioned social Darwinism being used as an excuse for slavery. And I just think it's fascinating because Darwin was hated slavery himself. He thought it was a horrible thing. There's a real good book called Darwin's Sacred Cause by Desmond and Moore that delineates that quite well. And just an aside, but I thought it was interesting.
Thank you, Brian, very much for your call. Rich in Rhinelander, hi.
Hi. Small point, but Joseph Sankey, who was named at the beginning of the hour, his last name, Sankey, is actually a number in, like, Italian. And I'm wondering, I know it's an odd point to bring up, but I'm wondering if that was a number that was assigned to him as a slave, and if anything is known of the actual African names of the people who were on the ship. The reason I bring this up is the woman I worked with, her last name was Davis, and in a forum one time she said, how does a woman as black as I am get a name like Davis? And she brought us all to awareness by saying, well, you know, like, if you're the property of the Davis family in the antebellum South, you wind up having a last name like Davis. So I'm wondering if your guest today, the author, knows whether Sankey was a reference to a numbering system for the slaves, which really dehumanizes people by numbering them.
Yes, it's a very interesting observation. That particular name, and in fact a whole set of Spanish names that were given to the Amistad Africans, grew out of a fraudulent document that was drawn up in order to make it seem as if they had already been in Cuba legally rather than more recently arrived illegally. So Cinque was one name, Francisco was another, Jose was another. They basically picked a – I don't know that there's any – actual connection to a number, but we do know what the actual African name of this man Sankey was. This has been a matter of considerable research, and I have to say it's not made easier by the fact that the Europeans who are, you know, passing through the jail, meeting the Africans, and many of them going home and writing letters and sometimes writing newspaper articles, these names are unfamiliar to them, so they really don't know how to write them and they don't know how to pronounce them. I actually kept a list at one point of all the different ways in which Sinke's name was spelled, and it ran to about 50.
Whoa!
50 different ways of saying his name. But we do know now that the Mende version of his name, and the Mende, by the way, are one of the largest ethnic national groups in southern Sierra Leone. The Mende name for this man was Sengbe, S-E-N-G-B-E, Sengbe. And we do actually know the African names of quite a few of them. It turns out that Sinke, that name persisted because he essentially became a celebrity associated with that name. In other words, when the New York Sun started reporting on the case, they drew a series of images, engravings, and lithographs, and they all said Joseph Sinke at the bottom. So this is how he became popularly known, and eventually he embraced that name, and after he learned to read and write in English, he would write letters and sign them Sinke. So that's the reason why I decided to use that name in the book. It was, in a sense, the name that grew up within the struggle for freedom. But your caller raises a very interesting point, because it is certainly true that the obliteration of an African past was a significant part of the violence of slavery, that you are no longer that name that you grew up with. You will now take the name that I, your slave owner, give you. That's a raw assertion of power.
Mm-hmm.
So this is definitely worth thinking about. And I think in the case of the Amistad Africans, many of them did preserve their original African names, and this was quite important to them.
Mm. Anything else, Rich? No, thank you so much. The picture of Sinké on the front of your book, it's a sympathetic portrait and very handsome and dramatic, and you feel like you want to sit down and talk to him, that he's worldly and well-read. It's very flattering. Where did this portrait come from?
That portrait on the cover of the book was drawn by an artist for the New York Sun.
Ah.
The very penny press paper that I've just mentioned. And there's an interesting story associated with that, because that particular image appeared in the newspaper, but they also had these images created as essentially something that could be framed on very high-quality paper. And I found a fascinating account in one of the numbers of the New York Sun, in which the editor said, "We have printed up many, many copies of this image of Sinké, and yet they all disappear immediately. So we're printing up more." So just imagine people out in the streets, you know, buying and selling from hand to hand these images of a man who just waged a successful rebellion against slavery. This is a really extraordinary thing to be happening in a slave society.
Yes. Let's talk a little bit more about, you write that Amistad had sailed into a huge and historic wave of slave resistance. Can you talk more about that?
Yes, certainly. One of the really crucial events in this early period of American history was a revolution that took place on the island or half island of Saint-Domingue, which is now Haiti.
Yes.
The Haitian Revolution, which began in 1791 and went on for about 13 years, at the end of which this small nation of slaves, basically, West African slaves, had managed to rise up and defeat the great imperial power of France and gain their freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this sent shockwaves around the Atlantic, including to the United States, because everybody feared that similar rebellions might break out in their own location. And in fact, how the news of the Haitian Revolution spread is a very interesting thing, because slave masters everywhere were terrified of it, but enslaved people everywhere were thrilled by it, to know that there had actually been a mass uprising that was successful. There was now a black republic. Well, the United States in particular, and Thomas Jefferson even more in particular, had a kind of pathological fear of the Haitian Revolution, especially the fear that it would spread to the United States. So the United States and France essentially isolated Haiti, tried to limit its influence, and ended up kind of crippling the country economically ever after. But in the late 1820s, an African-American here, a man named David Walker, produced a really powerful pamphlet or short book called David Walker's Address to the Colored Citizens of the World, in which he basically said, ours is a struggle for freedom. Freedom is our birthright, and we must all imitate the brave people in Haiti who rose up and seized their own freedom. So this was published in 1829. It was smuggled around because it was a very subversive document. Sailors, black sailors and white sailors, would sew the pamphlet into their clothing and then go ashore in places like Charleston, South Carolina, and then circulate the pamphlet secretly.
Ooh.
Well, this is the kind of situation that the Amistad Africans sailed into.
Mm.
Ferment was everywhere. Everybody did begin to think that slavery was going to come to an end. The Haitian Revolution had been the beginning of the end. Then the abolition of the slave trade had made another major dent, and then comes Britain and its colonies, and suddenly slavery looks like it's not going to last. So that's one of the things that fuels the debate in the United States when the Amistad Africans arrive on its shores.
More phone calls are welcome if you'd like to join our conversation with Marcus Redeker. He is the author, most recently, of The Amistad Rebellion, An Atlantic Odyssey of Slavery and Freedom. The story itself is one that's, it's good to refresh your memory of this story. Some of you may be hearing about the Amistad for the first time because heavens knows it was not front and center in history books for a long period of time. But it was resurrected in the 60s and 50s as we were looking at civil rights issues in this country at long last. And it was certainly resurrected by Steven Spielberg and his movie, Amistad. This book is interesting, Marcus's book, because he concentrates on the members of the Amistad Rebellion and traces their roots and why they did what they did and how they were received in the United States. And it's a fascinating story. Here's our number. Join us if you'd like. If not, you can just listen. You can do whatever you want. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. We have a Facebook page as well, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're welcoming more of your phone calls, 800-486-8655. Marcus Redeker, our guest, author of The Amistad Rebellion, An Atlantic Odyssey of Slavery and Freedom. David in De Pere is our next caller. Marcus, hi, David.
Hi. I'm interested in the history of the Walker family. He just mentioned David Walker, who wrote a book on freedom of the blacks. My great-great-grandfather, Captain Jonathan Lloyd Walker, was an abolitionist, and he had a ship that went down to Florida. He was captured trying to bring slaves back to Africa or wherever they would want to go. And I think he was from Boston, Massachusetts, or that area. And he was tried, and his hands were branded as SS for slave stealer. There's a statue of him outside of Grand Rapids, Michigan, or Muskegon, Michigan area there.
Marcus.
Yes, no, it's an absolutely fascinating story. And it is really an important part of this, what we might call maritime network of anti-slavery that I've just talked about. The truth is that seaports, ship captains, waterfronts were absolutely crucial to the economies of the southern states and also of the Caribbean islands and Brazil, and those areas could not be very easily controlled. So one of the really fascinating things about this era, and I have done a little writing about this, is that there was a kind of maritime underground railroad. Now, our image of the maritime of the underground railroad is landed. The idea is that people escaped north and they made it to free houses in border states, and then house by house they're taken up to Canada. And there was actually discussion about doing that with the Amistad Africans if the legal case should go against them. There was quite a discussion among abolitionists about this. But in my view, it seems much more likely that many more people escaped slavery by sea as stowaways, as people who signed on to a ship and promised to work, as people who were on the waterfront and who knew sailors and developed relations of trust and managed to escape that way. So Captain Walker, your ancestor, and I commend you for someone who engaged in a most honorable struggle against the institution of slavery and suffered for it, was one of many people of that kind who are still, to a large extent, unknown to us. Mm. The struggle against slavery is something we are still understanding almost day by day as scholars learn more and more about how many-sided it was.
Mm-hmm. So it may be the subject of another of your books yet to come, right?
I'm certainly considering it.
Yeah. Thank you, David. Interesting, interesting call. Harry is next in Madison. Hi, Harry.
Yes, I just want to make a comment and ask a question.
Sure.
My comment is that cinque seems to be a corruption of the Spanish number cinco, which means five. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's true. But my question is, does anybody know what happened to the men after they went back to Sierra Leone? And would they have been better off in Cuba than in the United States if they had been enslaved?
Yes, I think it is quite possible that cinque is a corruption of cinco. That's possible. We don't know for sure. There are other names that don't seem to have any obvious origin. But yes, we do know what happened to the Amistad Africans when they went back. And I should mention, too, they had the choice about whether to stay in the United States or go home. Once they were freed by the Supreme Court, once it became clear there was no longer any legal jeopardy, they were free people. And, of course, in their own minds, they had been free people all along. But it was up to them. And, in fact, the abolitionists were very curious about this. After they gave them the news, you're now free to do what you want, what are you going to do? And fascinating what they said. A man named Graveau said, we're going to think about it. We're going to think about this. We're going to hold a meeting. And I think what he meant was we're going to hold a Poro meeting. We're going to decide collectively according to our own traditions. And what they decided, and in fact what had been their consistent position all the way through, was that they wanted to go home. They wanted to go back to the places where they had lived. Freedom for them meant returning to their native lands. And this is just an unshakable conviction that they had from the beginning. Would they have been better off in Cuba? Certainly not. They would have, many of them, I think, been worked to death, literally, in the sugar plantation regions. Would they have been better off in the United States? It's hard to be sure, but you would have to remember the extraordinary difficulties of the lives of free African Americans at this time, and the degrees of poverty and the discrimination and the absence of good jobs. So they went back to southern Sierra Leone. A few of them actually stayed with the religious missionaries who returned with them, because one of the important parts of the story is that the abolitionists wanted to take the gospel of Christianity back to Africa. So on the ship that returned the Amistad Africans to Freetown, there were also five missionaries. And Cinque and the others actually helped the missionaries to acquire a place and to build a mission. But, of course, what the Amistad Africans really wanted was to go home to their families.
Mm-hmm.
A few of them did stay with the missionaries. All of the children who were not as able to be free on their own stayed with the missionaries. But eventually they almost all drifted away. We lose track of most of them. And in Cinque's case, there was a kind of bittersweet outcome to his freedom struggle. When he went back to find his wife and three children, what he discovered was that his entire village had been destroyed.
Oh, my.
The place where he and, I suppose, some hundreds of other people, maybe even thousands of other people, had once lived, had essentially been razed. It was gone. Apparently, he never saw his wife or children ever after, although there is some evidence to suggest that he may have gone to Jamaica to see if he could find them. Why they would be in Jamaica is an interesting question. There was a British effort to relocate people recaptured from the slave trade to places like Jamaica and the Bahamas and Barbados, so that may have happened. Cinque did maintain his independence, but he did also stay in touch with missionaries, and he did eventually return there, died at the mission, and was buried in the mission graveyard.
Don't you wish you had the complete story of his life?
Yes, it would be fascinating.
It sure would. Well, what you've written is fascinating, and I thank you so much for being with us. It's just, I can see why you have chosen this time of history to immerse yourself in, because it just doesn't get much more interesting than this, does it?
Well, this was certainly a dramatic set of events, and that was the thing that captured the imagination of the nation, and that was the very thing that made it such a powerful and influential event in its own time. I just hope that we can continue to remember it.
Yes. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Kathleen. Thank you.
Marcus Redeker, our guest this hour, his book is The Amistad Rebellion, An Atlantic Odyssey of Slavery and Freedom. Marcus is Distinguished Professor of Atlantic History at the University of Pittsburgh. He is also author of The Slave Ship, A Human History. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning, who produces this program, and thanks to you for all of your calls. It was quite a story, wasn't it? It's quite a story. We learned so much. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Great conversations ahead.